that new wave of energy. And we want you to stay tuned in. 90.7 here in the metro area, 91.9 in Points East, 104.3 Points South, and everywhere, KBOO.FM.
Good morning, it's 8:59, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next on the Old Mole Variety Hour, Fran Michel hosts, and topics include Trump's foreign policy, TriMet's new budget, and love under capitalism. That's next on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the We Can Listen, The Power of Being Heard event series happening monthly at the Old Church in Portland. This month, it takes place on Tuesday, April 11th at 7 p.m. This month, We Can Listen, The Power of Being Heard features Grammy-nominated recording artist Julianne Johnson, organizer of the Portland Women's March, Margaret Jacobson, musician and millennial, Mo Lincoln, and Rwandan facilitator of storytelling, Solange Iponoyimana. Again, that's We Can Listen, The Power of Being Heard, Tuesday, April 11th at 7 p.m. at the Old Church, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Radical Ecology Night, Thursday, April 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Radical Ecology Night features a screening of the documentary film Weed Eater and a presentation by the Pollinator Collective called The Birds and the Bees, Why They Are Dying and What You Can Do to Help. Again, that's Radical Ecology Night, Thursday, April 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. If I wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. If I was a baby in mama's arm, could nobody do me no harm. Lord, I wish I was a baby in mama's arm.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michel, stepping in for Clayton Morgeridge. Our engineer is Patsy Kahlberg. The mole is the creature that works underground to expose and undermine the entrenched power structures that lie below the surface of our commodified world, a world structured by the social arrangement we call capitalism, which gives the control of labor and the products of labor to the small and very wealthy elite who control the wealth we all produce and manage it in their own interests. That system also entails punishing the poor who resist or disobey, appropriating common resources, profiting from the promotion of war and other violence, and commodifying love and instrumentalizing interpersonal relations. On today's show, we'll be hearing about TriMet's plan to build a new transit police center and jail while appeals for comprehensive low-income fares go unanswered. We'll hear about what capitalism does to and with love, and we'll hear some thoughts about what to make of Donald Trump's foreign policy, or if he has one. If you miss any part of today's show or want to hear some or all of it again or to recommend it to your friends, you can find it in a day or two on the KBOO website. That's kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Today's show will be up in a day or two. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And you can contact us with comments, suggestions, or interest at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. First today, we hear Bill Resnick talking with Con Hallinan about Trump's foreign policy. Is there a pattern? Is he just an impulsive madman? Or are we looking at the throes of the wounded U.S. empire at the end of the American century? Bill?
Thank you, Fran. Con Hallinan, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Count Hallinan has taught journalism. He edited The People's World. He now writes for Foreign Policy and Focus, The Nation, many other journals. And a lot of his work is collected in his blog, Dispatches from the Edge. Count Hallinan, Trump seems to be pursuing a more, quote, muscular foreign policy. You courageously agreed to discuss the big picture of Trump and Trumpism in the world. Also to discuss how we can respond, that is, stop Trump and Trumpism, maybe produce a transformation of U.S. foreign policy. First, I think it would be good, though, to give some examples of what his administration is doing in these whirlwind of threatening and absurd things in this first, whatever it is, close to 3 months. And then we can, how do you understand it?
Well, the problem with trying to understand Trump foreign policy is it kind of depends upon which day it is. So that, you know, one day he's saying, you know, that Assad is going to have to be part of the solution in Syria, and then the next day they're you know, hitting airfields with cruise missiles and saying Assad has to go. So it's a very, use your term, impulsive. It's a very reactive kind of foreign policy. When he came in, he sort of said he wanted to stay out of the Middle East. He was very hawkish on China. And sort of, you know, let's see if we can't get some sort of resolution with the Russians. Well, now that's all turned around. So now, you know, his Secretary of State Tillerson made a statement yesterday about the Russians that, you know, sounds like straight out of the Cold War. Apparently Trump had a pretty, you know, low-key, agreeable meeting with the Chinese, and, you know, that went well. And here we are cruise-missiling Syria. So to try and find a pattern in there is difficult. And I do think there was something in the lead-in to the program and which explains some of it, which is that the United States is at a point where it can no longer control all the events in the world. Even militarily, it can't do it. You know, last wars that we won was Panama and Grenada, and so we're in this period of where there is a decline of the power of the Americans to influence world events and to sort of establish themselves. At the same time, we have this massive military force. You know, we spend 50% of all of the military spending in the world. And so it's a very unstable kind of period. On one hand, the United States is losing influence in the world, and at the same time, it's enormously powerful militarily. That can be a very dangerous kind of combination. I mean, the last thing you want is a country with enormous military power who's feeling insecure. You don't want that situation because it can be very volatile.
And especially with a leader who is so famously, notoriously, and crazily insecure, angry, and thin-skinned.
Amazing.
The thing he does is it's like a child's garden of neurotic behaviors of a three-year-old.
Exactly. It's really, you know, he holds grudges forever. He everything is you know, it's all focused on him. There's a lack of stability here, and that's where you say what is Trump's foreign policy? It's sort of like, well, I don't know, because you know, it's so impulsive. And my concern right now, I mean, if I were to, you know, point to the place that I think worries me the most right now is the Western Pacific and East Asia, particularly the South China Sea, because, you know, with the situation in Korea, Trump gave an interview to the Financial Times a couple of days ago in which he said, well, if China won't take care of Korea, we will. Now, what does that mean? is the United States really seriously considering attacking North Korea? And how would they do that? And what would be the effect on the rest of Asia? With the exception of Japan, every country in Asia and Southeast Asia is utterly opposed to a military confrontation with North Korea because they have no idea where it would go. And in the case of Syria, you know, was in a sense the attack on the Syrian airbase was a show. We destroyed a couple of MiG-21s. I didn't even realize MiG-21s should still fly. Blew up some hangars and things like that. Didn't even blow up the airfield for that matter. And they've dropped the matter. I mean, that they've just gone back to the way things were. In the case of North Korea, I have no idea what the North Koreans would do. If there was an attack, I imagine that it would be an attack aimed at their nuclear weapons, at their missile complexes, etc. Most of these are very well hidden. How would the North Koreans react? Would they then turn on South Korea? And Seoul is within easy artillery distance of North Korea, a city of what, 2 million people or something like that. I mean, it would just be a mess. Plus, of course, you could, if North Korea destabilizes, and South Korea and the United States take over, then suddenly China is faced with a potentially hostile power on its border, and it's not going to allow that.
Yeah, so, it seems to me. Let me add a few of the things to. I mean, the Chinese and the South China Sea. You've written on this. Trump could blunder into war really, really easily.
Yes.
And Khrushchev and Kennedy almost. In fact, exchanged nuclear weaponry, wars and over Cuba, and they were relatively rational people. Finally, they disengaged, made a deal. Trump, actions that are taken that look like bravado or just gunboat diplomacy, you know, people say, well, he's just staking out positions and frightening people and then forcing some kind of deal. But those, even if he were rational enough to think that way, all these actions have their own counteractions and more counteractions, which are going to expose him to humiliation unless he takes the next counteraction.
Well, that's I agree with you there.
There's something,
as you said, one of the things, I mean, psychologically about this guy is that he never likes to be bested, and he never likes to feel as if he's humiliated. Well, I mean,
and he never forgets, and he never forgets a loss.
No, and you know that's fine if you're dealing with your next door neighbor, you just kind of keep your distance from him. But if the guy has a nuclear weapon, that's suddenly a little bit different there. And certainly, the Chinese at this point are very upset about a number of things. They're upset about the growing tension with North Korea. They're upset about the fact that the United States is putting an anti-missile system, the THAAD, into South Korea and Japan. What they see is that the United States is ringing China with some 400 potentially hostile bases. You know, they're looking at this and they're seeing, you know, the 1950s and the containment strategy with the Soviet Union, and they don't like it. And it also stimulates some of the aggressive sides on the Chinese side as well, and some of their actions, for instance, in particularly in the South China Sea,
and they also want to protect their sacred honor, right? I mean, in some ways, they stake out positions, and they're the representative of the great Chinese people.
There's a little bit of great nation chauvinism
There's a horrible dynamics are occurring, and that's also true. It seems to me. You point out that an attack on Iran would be so devastating and horrible that they aren't contemplating it. I don't think that's right. I think Netanyahu is playing the same role that Israel played in the attack on Iraq, sort of in the background, providing some, a lot of intellectual weaponry.
What it is that there's a lot of division on that. Now, the Saudis and the Gulf Cooperation Council people, in other words, all the Gulf monarchies, and certainly some of the Israelis would like to see an attack on Iran. On the other hand, the Russians have very close relations with Iran, and they also have pretty close relationships with Israel. And the Russians have been pretty steadily saying to the Israelis, don't contemplate attacking Iran. You know, that's going to complicate things to an extent that that is not in your interest. I'm not sure that the Israelis at this point want to attack Iran. I think what they want to do is they want to keep them as the sort of bugaboo in the region. And of course, that's being done by Saudi Arabia and Turkey to a certain extent. You have these cross currents that are going on. And I've never seen this kind of complexity. I mean, just give you one short example on the Syrian civil war. You have Russia, Iran, Turkey, and Egypt pushing for a political settlement. At the same time, Turkey is attempting to do every single thing it can to undermine the Assad regime and is actually helping train this new army to fight the Russians and the Iranians. So, you know, these are just two completely bizarre cross currents that are going on at the same time. And to try and get some kind of logical, rational view of where this is going to go is really hard.
Yeah. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM. Portland, Oregon, we're trying to do something really hard is figure out what all this amounts to. And one thing that I think we can agree to, and that is certainly true, it's enormously dangerous what's happening. And this is not even to talk about his denial of climate change and there are long-term huge threats, and then there are all these short-term huge threats like war with China, attacking Iran, creating this sort of clash of barbarisms in the Middle East, where the whole Middle East, where the a terrible struggle between the various forces there, with the U.S. supporting the Saudis of all people, it seems to me that there's this tremendous danger, and particularly when it's led by this Miss Madman. You know, some people talk, let for a second discuss this, that really the great controller or the moderator of Trump has to be the U.S. military, saying to him, no, this is militarily impossible, this could lead to so much worse, you really have to change your thing, and then ultimately having to, in fact, resist the Trumpism and turn against him, because he may want to use the military also at home, because there's going to be a lot of resistance at home. And his popularity ratings could fall enormously, which would destroy the poor guy, at least if he recognizes it. What do you make of that scenario now?
Well, you know, I know I've heard this. People have talked about this. I'm always uncomfortable with the idea of the military being our savior.
I know.
The most common phrase in the military is yes, sir. I think that the military... I mean, like, for instance, with this thing with the Syria, the attack on the airfield in Syria, I think what happened was that he wanted to respond, and there was a bit of a payoff, and that was the military said, okay, look, we'll go take out this airfield, but you get Bannon off of the National Security
Council. That does seem sort of...
And I think that's what he did. I think he, you know... This is a guy, by the way, as you say, I mean, he really doesn't have any ideology except himself.
Yeah.
You know, his own... And so...
Well, he demands loyalty to himself, but he is absolutely disloyal to anything but his daughter and son-in-law, it appears.
Yeah, and who knows in the long run there either,
You know, family disputes sometimes escalate out of control, too.
But, you know, I think that the idea that... that the CIA or the National Security Council, the military, et cetera, will act as a check. I'm always very uncomfortable.
I agree. But in fact, at some point, you know, if you look at the logic of things, that may be one of the only barriers to him. We have to. We only have a couple more minutes, okay. Con Hallinan. And let me. This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking about to Con Hallinan, who writes a lot, dispatches from the edge is his blog. You can read a whole lot of him just by Googling and finding the articles and very thoughtful articles and knowledgeable. Any event, Con, we have to talk about. I think that. A real international response to Trump, bigger even than the response to the Iraq War, if you remember that, the international response was enormous, and it was enormous in the U.S. as well. Something on that line, but hugely bigger, it would have to be, I'm afraid. And moving also more positively towards a different foreign policy and international economic policy. We didn't even talk about the possible collapse of economies because of the uncertainty that he's causing for all. I mean, any event, that's another matter. Tell us about what can be done.
Well, I think in the short run, for one thing, I'm heartened by the fact that there has been so much response to what he's doing. I mean, here we in California, you know, we have a state sanctuary policy, not just city sanctuary policy. The whole state is a sanctuary. When the immigration order came through, obviously spontaneously, through the internet, tens of thousands of people just besieged airports all over the country. And what I'm heartened by is that there has been a very sharp response, a real challenge to Trumpism, and I think that is going to increase if only because the fact that Trump continues to do one thing after another, you know, the attempt to dismantle the medical care. It really caused a storm, in fact caused such a storm that they failed to do so. At the same time, of course, you know, he's now loaded the Supreme Court up, and I think this is going to be a long fight. I think it's got to be a very local fight, too. I think that people, the Democratic Party has very much gotten away from what their natural base ought to be and has really not done the kind of work that the Republicans have done on the local level. And so you have this situation where, you know, I saw a thing in Illinois or something, the Republicans won 54% of the vote, and they won 77% of the congressional seats in the state. You know, that kind of gerrymandering has gone on, and it's gone on because Democrats have just dropped the ball, and you know, they have not done their job.
No, it has to be outside of the Democratic Party.
Absolutely,
grassroots Democrats are many of them are really good people, and we have to work with them. Con, you have about two sentences more. We're running out of time.
Well, I think I hate to quote Winston Churchill, but I think what you do with Trump is you fight him on the beaches, you fight him on the landing zones, you fight him in the fields, you fight him in the villages. We just don't give up.
And in the media and on KBOO Radio, Con Hallinan, thanks so much for talking to
us. Thanks for having
me. We'll do it again.
Okay.
So long.
Okay, bye.
Right. Thank you.
That's from Symphony No. 1 in memory of the bombing of Dresden by Daniel Buchwitz. And before that, we heard Bill Resnick and Con Hallinan discussing Donald Trump's foreign policy, such as it is. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Next up, Desiree Helligers interviews Huey Ong, Executive Director of Opal Environmental Justice Oregon, about their organizing work with Bus Riders Unite and about TriMet's 2018 budget proposal, which includes $11 million for a new Rose Quarter Transit police station and jail, as well as ramped up policing of fare evasion. This interview was pre-taped on April 5th.
My guest today is Huey Ong with Opal Environmental Justice Oregon. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're actually meeting in the offices of Opal, so I guess I'm joining you.
No, it's great.
You want to tell us a little bit about Opal?
Yeah, so for over 10 years, we've been organizing to build power in our communities for environmental justice and civil rights. We actually were founded to address air quality issues in North and Northeast Portland. But as good organizers, people that have knocked on doors and are talking about air quality in North and Northeast Portland, we were finding that the community were actually lifting up a lot of transportation needs as development was happening. And as an environmental justice organization, we listened to the community and our folks, and actually started to do a lot of transportation work. Environmental justice is an interdisciplinary practice where we have to draw the connections of different issues. So although we initially started around air quality, we started heavily working around transportation and what it might mean to also then to address some of the housing issues even way back then, 10 years ago.
So you were really active in the inclusionary zoning campaign.
Over, I believe those three sessions, we led the statewide coalition to remove the ban on inclusionary housing policy options for local jurisdictions, and recently passed the implementation phase of it in Portland, which is a big victory, knowing that we are in a current housing crisis and our communities feel it, both that are transit dependent and low income folks of color. Those are the communities we organize are being pushed further and further out of the urban core and center. At Opal, we really lift up the stories of those directly impacted. So having both renters, low-income folks, folks of color, talk about the intersectionality of the housing crisis, where we see some of our members having to move not just once a year, but multiple times in a single year, has real impacts on stability and family and security.
In the face of that kind of gentrification, people being forced out of the core, affordable transit becomes that much more critical. Mm-hmm. And so you've done a lot of organizing with Bus Riders Unite, which has been a huge campaign, and I was rather shocked to discover that a transit riders jail is being proposed.
Yeah, so Bus Riders Unite is Portland's transit riders union. So low-income folks, folks of color that are transit-dependent, really found Bus Riders Unite as a space to really engage in the issues around service, access, accessibility, and have identified a wide range of different campaigns over the years, and with direct action and organizing have won really amazing things. We've won an extension for the bus transfers a few years back. We've won $1.3 million litigation fund. That's annual, which is a huge victory. And as they were rolling out this e-fare card transition, without the input from directly impacted folks and riders themselves, we actually had a push on TriMet to address a lot of concerns of the ability to still use cash, the cost of the fare, and then the actual makeup of who rides the service itself. So the push for having a multi-rider card, so folks that are traveling with family can actually just use one card. We saw some positive victories come out of that. And then that transition into us moving towards the development of a low-income fare. So Bus Riders Unite did both research and initiated a process over almost 2 years ago to actually push on TriMet to create a low-income fare. Mm-hmm. We're seeing some progress because I think there was some energy being put to building up a low-income fair task force, which initially didn't have any community organizations on it, and organize both Metro and TriMet to make sure that there were seats for, you know, the constituents that actually use the service to actually be part of the process to build up the low-income fair. And I think that was a conversation that we saw some viral fruits. So it was a shock to us that in the February board meeting of TriMet, that where they revealed the budget for 2018, that we discovered an $11 million, a little bit over $11 million transit police station being built near the Rose Quarter. Their justification is that they are leaving a current lease, or would leave or break a lease that would save them money. And we just have larger concerns, because if you talk to riders, and particularly low-income riders and riders of color, who has disproportionately been impacted by the ticketing and the citations of fare evasions.
And the elimination of a free ride zone.
In downtown Portland a few years back.
2012, yeah.
It was very disconcerting that we were having conversations about a low-income fare where TriMet was at the table, where the fare program would cost about $12 million, and then to see in a budget a transit police station that cost about the same amount of money being prioritized, and there's no mention in the budget presentation about a low-income fare. So we're at this point where our members, right, have historically really applied the pressure to make sure that riders' voices are heard in decision-making. It's a core principle of ours that directly impacted people have a say in decisions that impact their lives. So those that have felt criminalization and have felt the increased presence of police on and transit police on the system itself, seeing a prioritization, more policing, and the militarization of our transit system is very troubling. So we're gearing up and building out a robust campaign to both lift up the need for the low-income fare to be fully funded, as well as the reprioritization and clarity of why a transit police station is being built and no mention of a low-income fare. So that's something we're gearing up. We're doing both the base building and organizing, because you're right, a lot of people actually don't know what's happening.
And that's a pretty recent development, right?
Yeah, it's one of those. TriMet will try to say that, we've been working on this for a few months, and, we share something in this memo and talk to any writers, they would never seen that memo, right? So it's like, what is the public engagement, and how are you actually sharing information and providing a space for community input?
So is there already a transit riders police station somewhere when you say that their lease is coming up?
Yeah, there's several transit police stations. Mm-hmm. Some have been built, but resources that would have been better off served in other ways.
So what function do those transit riders stations or police stations play at other sites? Like, are people who are found without fare cards, are they detained there? Are they charged there? I mean,
research we're all doing. What's interesting is that they moved it towards the Rose Quarter, where there's a higher percentage of fare evasion that happens. So I think there's some rationale that they have that I think they're trying to be able to ticket and process things quicker, perhaps, or use that as a place to actually build out more of a police presence. We believe transportation is like a right. And fundamentally, it connects people to work, to school, to health access, to public services for a lot of transit-dependent folks. And our community is low-income folks, folks of color, some folks that, because of current situations, don't have driver's cards or don't have a driver's license, are unable to drive, because we also organize folks with disabilities and folks that are from the elderly community and youth, right? We organize a wide range of folks that are also transit-dependent for different reasons. And to have more of a police presence in this day and age is actually the wrong direction. Having more guns on buses is not a good thing. You can ask any person of color, and it's amazing. And it's that TriMet will try to say that riders actually want to see more police presence. And I think more security. And it's one of those things where you ask a lot of people, you might get a majority of folks saying, yeah, more police would be great. But if you talk about very specific communities, folks of color, low-income folks who have historically been targeted by police and police presence, they'll tell you a totally different story.
Yeah, so it's pretty shocking, too, that you're asking for $12 million for low-income fare, and they're about to spend $11 million on this new transit station.
TriMet is a billion-dollar agency, and if they want to prioritize something, they will find the resources to prioritize it. So we want to see TriMet really look at their budget closely, and we're willing to work with them on multiple levels to, reevaluate the priorities. Because if they want to actually provide access to low-income folks and address some of the huge needs where, as our folks get pushed out further and further, access to affordable transportation and what good bus services is critical to hold the line around this attack on poor people. So it's one of those things where, as an agency, if you prioritize it, you can find the ways to actually leverage your budget to meet the needs of your riders.
Right, and certainly, from the standpoint of climate change, right, we need to be bolstering up low-impact forms of transportation, right, sustainable forms of transportation rather than limiting them.
Yeah, I think everyone talks about technology. There's a huge push for, driverless, EV vehicles, which is all super fun and exciting technology, but let's actually pause a little bit and think about what infrastructures and what mass public transportation can also do to impact our carbon footprint, but also to connect the city in a very different way. To work, to jobs, to schools, it's a lifeline for a lot of folks, and sometimes people don't have the resources, so they ferry evade, right? Because they still have to make their appointments and they still have to make their make it to their job on time, so those are all critical interconnected issues. So we work on housing, we work on access to green space, and what community power looks like is so critical because we're the targeted communities when it comes to decisions around budgets and resources.
Yeah, so how can our listeners join in pushing back against this proposed budget item?
Yeah.
And for, just more inclusive transportation.
Yeah, sign up, opalpdx.org is a, ways for folks to volunteer and get engaged. We're on the buses, organizing and talking to riders. We're in the communities and we go to places where we know low-income folks. And as folks gather to discuss issues and listen to folks and their concerns. We're organizing both testimony, so we encourage both individual folks to show up. If you're part of organizations, or community groups, we've heard from some communities that there's concerns. We actually don't actually know, and there's not a definitive stance that China has taken around their work with ICE, right, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, right? We want, our transportation system to also be a place where it is accessible for all of our communities. And although they say that they don't cooperate with ICE, there's actually nothing definitive. They always, fall back onto the state statute that says, we want to cooperate with ICE agents. But cooperation could mean a lot of different things, right? So
even just not having enough fare at any given moment could put somebody in the pipeline for deportation now, given this move to deport people for really minor offenses.
Yeah, we really got to identify, what are the ways our communities actually end up engaging with law enforcement? What are the mechanisms? What are the low-level offenses that get people in front of different law enforcement agencies? But then, who knows what type of collaboration or engagement they have with other law enforcement agencies, right? And that's a real concern, right? Because it's actually not clear in TriMet's stance what that does or does not look like.
So, I just want to get in a quick plug for the People's Climate March, which you've also been working on, right?
Yeah.
So coming up on April 29th.
So OPAL is super excited that we, working with the Oregon Just Transition Alliance, which is an alliance of community organizations that are organizing frontline communities across the state of Oregon that are centered around building out organizing capacity in low-income communities and communities of color to address a wide range of issues, to to call for a people's climate movement as a sister mobilization to the national people's climate movement happening April 29th. And locally here, we want to lift up frontline communities and the intersectionality of the different people of color-led campaigns. April 29th is 100 days out of this administration, but we know this administration is part of a long legacy of climate inaction as well as policies that has directly impacted frontline communities. Frontline communities are communities that are the least contributors of climate change but are hit first and worst by climate inaction. So you know, we want to draw the connection of, you know, what does it mean for folks engaging in resiliency work on the ground around housing, transportation, immigration. We will definitely be lifting up this transit police station as a core issue as we're talking about the economy that we currently are part of and the economy we want, right, shared with. And if you hang around OPO long enough, you'll start hearing us talk about a just transition from what we call an extractive, exploitative economy to one that's cooperative and regenerative. And that's built through a framework that transitions us away from the bad to the good in a way that centers frontline communities making decisions of what that transition looks like.
You've been listening to an interview with Huey Ong, Executive Director of OPAL Environmental Justice Oregon. While a March 8th TriMet press release about the 2018 proposed budget specifically addresses what it calls safety enhancements, the press release notably makes no mention of the proposed $11 million to be allocated to the Transit Riders Police Station Jail and ramped up policing of fare evasion. In a brief phone interview, TriMet spokesperson Roberta Alstead took issue with descriptions of the new facility as a jail, but she confirmed that it would, in fact, include 2 to 3 holding cells. I asked Ms. Alstead if the new facility would include space to interrogate people who are being detained. She took issue with my use of the word interrogate, but acknowledged that, yes, contrast to the existing facility, the new space would have room devoted specifically to the purpose of questioning people who've been detained. Public hearing on the TriMet budget is scheduled for Wednesday, April 26th at 8 a.m. in the White Stag Building at 70 Northwest Coach Street. OPAL will be hosting art and sign-making parties to prepare for the meeting. For more information, you can email OPAL at info@opalpdx.org or call 503-774-4503. This has been Desiree Helgers for the Old Mill Variety Hour.
What you think happens to the money from your taxes? The government's the addict. With $1 billion a week, kill brown people habit. And even if you ain't on the front line, when Massa yell crunch time, you right back at it. Man, look at how you hustling backwards. At the end of the year, add up what they subtracted. 3 out of 12 months, your salary pay for that madness.
That was Uncle Sam by Brother Ali. And before that, we heard Desiree Helliger's interview with Huey Ong about policing on TriMet. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, non-commercial, listener-sponsored community radio station. Next on the Old Mole, Clayton Morgridge will share a reflection about how capitalism affects our love lives.
In 1972, British writer David Widgery wrote this article about the bitter intensity of love in capitalism, and why and how love must be tamed and commodified in capitalist society. It was recently republished on the website of Red Pepper magazine. Some things have changed, at least a little, in the 40-plus years since this was written, but I leave it to you to think about how much these thoughts still ring true. Sexual love is the movement that breaks the rules, an uprising of the senses that abolishes propriety. Time alters. A gasp lasts an hour. A night separates into heaps of minutes. A conversation from bar to bed to bus stop. Has it been a fortnight or a day? Objects floor you with sudden meanings. A weed becomes a flower beside a canal that is an ocean. A shell swells with feelings. Touches echo. Nerves misbehave. Hands ricochet. Eyes kindle and melt in a world of constantly altering surfaces. Love offers a glimpse of the most intimate communication that we have experienced. everything that's said about love is true, except the happy ending. To love in capitalism has an especially bitter intensity. It is to repossess feelings that capitalism makes foreign. Emotions that come without rules or prices or power attached to them. In love's bed, mutual subjectivity allows absolute altruism. The precious is given without price. The delight lies in delighting another. We recover that which we have been taught to withhold, avoid, or have had shaken out of us by parents and teachers and each other. It is a state of revolution against the discolored flatness which is the normal sleep-work-play life. Lovers win permission for a short parole to trail after the ditch flowers, to stare through the swirls of harbor water to the stone, and become entranced by the dart and hover of storm clouds. Sexual love cannot be hoarded, accumulated, or displayed. Neither moth nor rust can corrupt it. In general, the individualism so avidly developed in us by the capitalist system is for external application. We are persuaded to distrust our emotions when they conflict, as they usually do, with competitive success. If we are going to get somewhere and make something of ourselves, education, not experience, should be our guide. Advertising schools us. The slogans batter us down. Get without giving. Take what you can. Look after number one. But even capitalist society has to honor love, however much it loathes its expression. For love is a zone of subjectivity, which also has official approval, a precarious holiday where feelings are supposed to rule. Love allows you briefly to return to what was once yourself. It is not hard to see why such an unruly state of mind has to be strictly rationed and kept controlled with greeting cards, marriage licenses, and marzipan cakes. It is unpredictable, disorderly, and bad for industrial relations. It's too simple, too difficult, and doesn't consume enough. For the effective growth of commerce, it should only occur once in life. Its emotions must be surrounded with regulations, icing sugar, and lace, made as well-behaved as possible. It would be easier if it didn't exist, this love, and for many it never does. But it has proved quite impossible to remove the gnaw or eradicate the itch. So it has been turned into something quite different. Sex itself must be turned into work with its own rules and games. It is forced back into the black sack of marriage, a contract to feel in a matter whose very essence lies in its voluntary nature. The echoing sense of unbroken subjectivity is made silly and impossible to sustain. Such love needs more space than 5 football fields. That kind of love becomes, in practice, a privilege for the rich. The rest of us are left to read about the affairs of movie stars and the loves of princesses. Ordinary love is locked up in its own company, given guards called jealousy and fidelity, taken out in public once a month, and stifled to death beneath the TV and the diapers. The underside of love surfaces. Passion now wants its penalties. A once equal love capsizes and becomes itself the subject of the division of labor. The man is the human being who has to be kept fueled and sustained, fit to do his stuff in the outside world. Love can quickly become a species of tyranny, a word offered and withheld like a dog's biscuit, a word that turns suddenly into a slap, a trap, a threat. Do you love your mommy? Means reward me for your dependence. Love becomes involuntary, a system of emotional awards, promised, stored, and exchanged. The platitude that love is close to pain becomes cruelly true. The intensity of violence replaces the gentleness of love. Violence is the occupational disease of a wife. Men beat their female partners regularly who would never harm their dog. But the slow death of love is a different sort of pain, full of guilt and dread and exhaustion. Love becomes an oath or a pang or a regret. But mulling over memories while contriving to be lovely to come home to is apt to produce a mawkish and sickly romanticism, no use to anyone. The evidence of loveless marriage lies in the concealed and unrecorded doorstep grumbles and smoothed-over rows in public bars, to be kept from the outside world if it can be. How the economic setup of the family mutilates the emotions of love and the unequal relations of the sexes, turning a particular pair of lovers into sparring partners, is not the most important crime of a system which can starve whole continents and destroy and make ugly entire cities. But it is one of the saddest. Feelings which have regulated life itself are relegated to a mere memory. Once mixed up with marriage and corrupted with cash, love is bent into a certain shape which no longer fits its feelings. People are sorted into twos and marched up to the wedding cake. The family is a convenient self-financing unit of competitive consumption and indoctrination, the original sweatshop where production, repair, and reproduction are carried out by an unsafe, unpaid, and underappreciated women workforce. For the state, it is cheap at its price. No need to spend on good public transport, comprehensive group care for young children, community centers, or restaurants, if everyone does it at home, one by one. Exhaustingly, inefficiently, expensively, the family then sits in front of the TV to watch still more invented happy families serving out their frosted flakes. If the family is breaking down, that is the occasion for rejoicing, not dismay. We need to start finding alternatives and demanding the facilities to make them work, not trying to force the broken pieces back together again. I've been reading an edited version of David Widgery's 1972 article republished on the website of Red Pepper Magazine. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
You don't bring me flowers. You don't sing me love songs.
You hardly talk to me anymore. When I come through the door at the end of the day,
I remember when you couldn't wait to love me, you used to hate to leave me.
That was Barbara Streisand and Neil Diamond with You Don't Bring Me Flowers, illustrating Clayton Morgridge's comments on how standard-issue marriage is in capitalist society today. Take the joy out of love. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Fran Michelle, and I have a few items for the Old Mole Action Calendar, things you can do, places you can go to contribute to a better world in the age of Trump. The Community Alliance of Tenants and Stable Homes for Oregon Families are providing transportation and other resources for those who register to join them in Salem on Wednesday to lobby state legislators to support tenant rights. Buses leave different neighborhoods in Portland at 7 or 7:30 a.m. You can find more information and the link to register on the calendar at pdxactivist.org, or you can email Pam at oregoncat.org. This is about House Bill 2004, which passed, lifting the ban on rent control and introducing controls in the use of no-cause evictions, but that bill now goes to the Senate. Portland Tenants United has more information at pdxtu.org, including a list of senators who need convincing. Senators Courtney, Burdick, DeBeer, Robian, Beyer, Winters, Haas, and Monroe. If you can't make it to Salem that day, you can phone them every day, telling them to support tenants' rights. And you can, again, find more information at PDXTU, Portland Tenants United, pdxtu.org. On Thursday, you can join the growing movement to form public banks and get ready to support Commissioner Udaly's work on this by going to the next meeting of the Portland Public Banking Alliance, Banking in the People's Interest. That's this Thursday, April 13th at 7:30 p.m. in the First Unitarian Church in the Buchan Building, room B302 at Southwest 12th and Salmon. And you can find out more on their website by searching for Portland Public Banking. There are more opportunities for getting involved listed on the Portland Resistance Calendar on the KBOO website. That's kboo.fm. And that wraps up the Old Mole Variety Hour for today. Thanks to our engineer today, Patsy Kahlberg. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Con Hallinan for their discussion of Trump's foreign policy. To Desiree Helligers and Huey Yong for letting us know about the proposed TriMet jail. To Clayton Morgeridge for reading David Widgery's piece about love and bourgeois marriage and for doing all the preparation work for this show. I'm Fran Michel, inviting you to join us again next Monday at 9 for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground perspective. You can find today's show online at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can hear any or all of today's show as well as past shows. You can send links to your friends. Today's show should be up in a day or two. You can keep updated on the Mole's activities by liking us on Facebook and following us on Twitter. Now, stay tuned to KBOO for coming up. On April 10th, this Monday, at 10 a.m., Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein looks at the inner life of cats, the science and secrets of our mysterious feline companions. At 11, Health Watch hears from the author of An Inside Job and presents steps to pursue physical, emotional, and spiritual healing from cancer. And at 11:30, Radio Zine talks to Dr. Lauren Olson, author of Finally Getting Out, Letting Go of Living Straight, his story of evolving sexuality and coming out as gay later in life. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by donating, by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Be sure to tune in again next Monday morning at 9 a.m. for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Good morning. It is just now a minute and a half before 10 o'clock. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
K-
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Morning.